This is Sports Jam. I'm Doug Doyle, and my guest, wow, what can you say about this executive from the National Football League? He has so many honors. Scott Pioli, the assistant general manager of the Atlanta Falcons. Scott, great to have you on the show.
Oh, Doug, it's an honor to be here with you. It really is.
Now, you're joining us from Nantucket for this show, and there's so much I want to talk to you about, because not only are you just one of the top executives in the NFL for more than 20 years, but also your philanthropy work, your love of jazz, it's something that, you know, people might not be aware of just how many things you're involved in. But let's start off with ESPN said that you were the NFL Personnel Man of the Decade for the 2000s, and Sporting News named you the NFL Executive of the Decade. When you heard that, what was your reaction?
Overrated. No, I mean, honestly, things like that happen, Doug, because you're generally surrounded by a lot of really good people. And I was fortunate, you know, that run, that decade had to do, you know, 9 of my 10 years spent with the New England Patriots. And I was fortunate to have a great partner, Bill Belichick, who everyone knows is arguably one of the finest, or if not the finest, coach in NFL history. And to have a great quarterback in Tommy Brady. And on top of that, there's just a lot of really good players and a great support system and tremendous ownership. So when I hear about things like that, it's any of the individual awards, not just for me, but for anyone, generally have to do with the people that they're surrounded with. I was very fortunate during that decade.
No time on the clock, and the Patriots have won Super Bowl 36. Unbelievable.
Three Super Bowls during that amazing run from 2000 to 2008 you spent with the New England Patriots. You know, you even tried coaching at one point. You were coaching at Murray State for a couple of years. Now that you've had a chance to be an executive for so many years, and you've worked with one of the greatest coaches of all time, Bill Belichick, and you've worked with many terrific coaches, what's the major difference between coaching and being an architect of a team?
Well, you know, for me, it was totally unintentional. As you mentioned, Doug, I got into this, you know, when I first started out, my goal in life was to go back to my hometown in Washingtonville, New York, and be the head coach at Washingtonville High School. That's what I thought I was going to do with my life. And then I had some pretty cool opportunities after I got done playing. And, you know, so I coached, as you mentioned, for 2 years at Syracuse University as a graduate assistant coach, got my master's there, and then 2 years as a full-time coach at Murray State University in fabulous, fabulous Murray, Kentucky. And, you know, after that, Bill had just been hired as the head coach of the Cleveland Browns, and he was looking for a couple of young football guys to come in that he was going to be having doing a multitude of things. And while I was there, I did a little bit of stuff with quality control, coaching stuff, but primarily personnel work and scouting work. And as I did it, I really tended to gravitate towards the personnel side and really enjoyed the draft and draft preparation and researching players and evaluating players. And honestly, I found that I actually enjoyed the personnel part and the salary cap stuff and the contract negotiation part just as much, if not more, than the coaching part. And I guess the real truth is, in addition to really liking it, I think I was a better evaluator than I was a coach. And that made the path really pretty easy for me in terms of having the appropriate amount of passion to do the job that I wanted to do.
Well, a lot of people would love to have the success that you've had, because wherever you have gone, there have been changes for the better from teams that weren't having so much success to going all the way up to the top. How about your years with the Jets as the director of pro personnel for the Jets from 1997 to 99? When you have to think of that time, what's the best memory you have about your time there with the Jets?
I think the best memory I had was it was the first time I've been fortunate enough to be a part of some success at the Cleveland Browns, right? We had an 11-win season. We went to the playoffs. And then spent a year with the Baltimore Ravens, and we were building something new there. But I think what happened at the Jets was I was exposed to one of the most remarkable coaching staffs that I've ever been around. And at the time, I mean, that staff consisted of Bill Parcells as the head coach, Bill Belichick as the defensive coordinator, Al Groh, Romeo Crennel, Charlie Weiss, Dan Henning, Maurice Carthon, really some remarkable coaches. And you know, within a couple of years, in our second year, we won 12 games, went to the AFC Championship game, and it was my first opportunity to see some of the things that I had been taught to believe in and some of the things I believed in terms of values of team building, watch them come to fruition and then have success. And I think the thing that I take away from the Jets experience more than anything was just being around a great bunch of people who were really aligned at the professional level on winning and winning games and winning with the right kind of people. And we were able to do that. Now, I had seen that at the college level when I was at Syracuse working under Dick McPherson. He had a very similar model and a very similar program built at Syracuse, which is why he was so successful there. And I was, again, fortunate enough to be a part of Coach McPherson's, his staff up there.
You have a master's from Syracuse in television and film, and you brought that to full use in 2013 when you were the analyst on NBC's Football Night in America and Sirius XM Radio. Did you enjoy that? How difficult was that for you?
The degree part or the job in 2013. In terms of the job, it was very difficult, quite honestly, because all throughout my career, as I worked and as jobs changed, I always seemed to work for organizations where there was always a very strong head. It was a head coach and player-driven model where they were always the people out in the really out there publicly. So I hadn't had a lot of experience dealing with the media, being in the media, even though I had got my bachelor's and my master's degree, you know, in television and film and in communication. I hadn't spent a whole lot of time in and around the media, which was always very, you know, was fine with me. And even the 9 years with the Patriots and the 3 Super Bowls and the with the success we had, we had a model that I really liked and was a big part of and stayed away from the media. So part of going into the media was also very intentional in terms of wanting to get better at something that I feel that I did a very poor job of as a general manager, you know, in my time in Kansas City. I didn't put myself out there and I didn't, you know, involve myself with the media a whole lot. And again, it was an opportunity to get, you know, to get better at something. But the people I worked with, I mean, the folks at Sirius XM were fantastic. Steve Cohen, who was my boss, was terrific. I got to work with Bob Papa. You know, spent 4 days a week in New York City, which was terrific, between the NBC show on Sunday nights and the Sirius XM. So it was a terrific experience on a lot of different levels.
And you mentioned you from Washingtonville, New York, where you spent time as quite an athlete, and then playing a defensive tackle at Central Connecticut State, a member of the Hall of Fame. You were there from 83 to 87, but you were inducted into the Hall of Fame there at Central Connecticut State in 2005, and you're also, I believe you're the third member, Scott, of the National Italian American Sports Hall of Fame. In 2014, you went into that hall in Chicago. Marty Licori and Mario Andretti have also been guests here on the show. So I think you're number three.
Oh, very cool.
But that's another great honor. A Hall of Famer who happens to be the son-in-law of Hall of Famer Bill Parcells.
Ladies and gentlemen, presenting Bill Parcells for enshrinement into the Pro Football Hall of Fame, George Martin.
I know there are a lot of deserving people out there. Some deserve it more than I do. But I want to tell the committee members that none of those could possibly appreciate it more than I do. I'm extremely grateful. The only thing I would ask them to do is when they put my bust in the hall tomorrow, I'd like to be somewhere near Lawrence Taylor so I keep an eye on that sucker.
Is this a normal relationship between dad and son-in-law?
You know, honestly, it is. People are always intrigued by it. But, you know, I had been working in the NFL for a number of years before I worked for Bill and before I met my wife. And the only time that it wasn't normal and it was, I don't want to say awkward, but it was difficult, I think, for Bill and myself was the year that in 1999 when, you know, we were actually, my wife and I were actually married. And, you know, we were both trying hard to make sure that we had a definitive line between the boss and, you know, family. And truthfully, it's been a tremendous relationship because he's always been more of a father-in-law and a very normal father-in-law than he has been the boss. We only had one of those years together like that. So it's been a very normal, again, son-in-law, father-in-law relationship.
And it's true that you didn't know that who Dallas was when you met her there at Jets camp?
Yeah, it is true. And actually, she had been working with my sister in Mahwah, New Jersey, for Sharp Electronics. So my sister worked for Sharp Electronics for a number of years, and my wife Dallas had was working for Sharp Electronics, and they had worked together for 7 years. And Mahwah is only about 20 minutes from my hometown. So when we met, she knew all the people from my hometown, and there was a lot of common ground there, which made things a lot easier. And the fact that she could put up with this crazy business that I work in made things a lot easier.
Tell us a little bit about your daughter, Mia.
Oh, she's the absolute love of my life. She just turned 13. And I've been told that these are the years I got to start thinking about and worrying about because they start to change, and I see her changing. But she's a remarkable young lady. She's just, like I said, she's the love of my life.
Is she a football fan?
She is. She is. And she's been, although I think I've confused her over the years because she was born in Providence when I was with the Patriots. Lived there for 5 years, and then took her to Kansas City, where she lived for 5 years, and so she was a Chiefs fan, and then we're now in Atlanta, so she's a Falcons fan. So the good news is that she still loves me enough where she's a fan of Daddy, so she supports the team that I'm working for, so that makes it a little bit easier.
Good evening, everyone. The Kansas City Chiefs got their man.
The Chiefs have reached a deal to hire as their new GM, Scott Pioli, the man who helped build a dynasty in New England.
We're speaking with Scott Pioli here on Sports Channel. How difficult is it to be just like a player who you've been around a number of different teams in a number of different cities to have a so-called normal life with your wife and child?
Well, you know, that's it's funny. I'm talking to you from Nantucket right now. This has been the one stabilizing, common ground, I guess, so to speak, for our life. It's been difficult because, you know, I grew up in Washingtonville, New York, lived there for 18 years before I went off to college for 5 years in Connecticut. And then from that time on, I've kind of bounced around from Syracuse to Kentucky to Cleveland to Baltimore to back to New York. So I've kind of bounced around, and it's very foreign to someone like myself in the house or the family that I grew up in. My parents moved out of the Bronx in 1964, the year before I was born, and God bless them both. They're both still living in the same house in Washingtonville that I was born in. So it's very different. But that's part of the reason we have this home in Nantucket. You know, after having a little bit of success, we were able to build a summer home. And the one constant that we have in our life is this house here in Nantucket, where my family gets to spend a lot more time in it, but at least some of the things look familiar when I come back every year.
You mentioned your parents. Do they get the credit? You have been someone who has been giving back almost since day one of your career as an executive. You have philanthropy efforts that result in diversity, women's issues. Does that stem from back home?
Oh, absolutely. Everything that I do, I always make it about the Pioli family and not necessarily myself. And it comes from, you know, my mom is from Maspeth, Queens. My dad's from the Bronx, from Wallace Avenue. And they grew up, and they're still to this day two of the hardest working people I've ever met in my life. And I also have to throw my dad's mom in there too, Grandma Rosa Anna Costa Pioli. Nice Italian name if you like those Italian names.
Yeah, absolutely.
But my parents, even though that they had very limited opportunities in life, which they had very, very limited opportunities, they always impressed certain things upon us. And education was always at the top of that list. So the things that have always remained important to me that I do from a philanthropy standpoint not only have to do with education, but it has to do with the arts. And, the other component that we talk about is diversity and women's rights, because, my Grandma Rose was one of the strongest women I've ever met in my life. My mother's an incredibly strong woman, and I've got two older sisters who are very strong. And growing up, when I grew up, you know, it was a time where you could see the limitations, right? My sisters grew up as kids of the 70s and mid-70s, late 70s. And at that time, the world was starting to change because of Title IX, but it wasn't really changing, right? At the beginning, in 1972, Title IX was this thing that was put out there, and it was a law that was passed, but it was not really in effect. And still to this day, there's a lot of things that aren't even close to equal. So those things are very important to me because of my family and the people around me.
How big a smile goes on Scott Pioli's face when the United States women's soccer team gets a championship, when we have really a dream team headed to Rio as far as the women's basketball team? Is anybody even going to come close to these ladies?
I hope not. I hope not. I know I'll be supporting them. I remember watching the Women's World Cup with my daughter and my wife. And, I love to watch women's sports. It's funny. Our daughter Mia is playing lacrosse now and in middle school. She's going to be an eighth grader this year, and she's really fallen in love with the game of lacrosse. And I got to tell you, the truth is we spend more time watching women's lacrosse and women's basketball on television than we do any other sports. And that probably includes football, to tell you the truth.
Well, I have to tell you that my daughter, who is starting a teaching career here in Newark, a fifth grade teacher in Newark in the fall, when she started lacrosse, I said, "Now, you do realize your dad played basketball and baseball and played football early on. I can't help you with lacrosse. Can you help me with lacrosse? Do you have any idea how to hold and catch that ball?"
Here's the deal. I can throw it and catch it, but she's still trying to teach me how to cradle, and she laughs at me a lot when I try to cradle and I try to do things. You know, it's the sport is booming right now, and it's really starting to pick up in Atlanta and in the South in general. And there were pockets of New York where, you know, it was very popular in Central New York and Western New York and, of course, on Long Island when I was growing up. But in Orange County, New York, and Orange, Ulster, in those areas, it really wasn't a big sport. So I really don't know a whole lot about it, but my daughter's teaching me as we go along here, that's for sure.
And probably the best lacrosse player ever was also a guest on Sports Jam. Jim Brown talked about his days at Syracuse and how he changed the sport.
Yeah, he was amazing. You know, in my 2 years at Syracuse, you know, Jim Brown is obviously is revered in Syracuse, New York, and at Syracuse University. But just outside the graduate assistant football office, there was a photograph of two photographs next to one another of Jim Brown. And, you know, because he was an All-American football player, which everyone knows that, but he was also an All-American lacrosse player. And, until years ago, or even now, is considered, as you mentioned, being one of the greatest lacrosse players of all time. And there was this picture of Jim in his football uniform, and then right next to it was him standing in his lacrosse uniform with back in the 50s with the short shorts and the tank top. And holding a lacrosse stick, and he's an absolute physical specimen. And you look at what he looked like in the, you know, mid to late 50s, it's easy to understand why he was one of the greatest athletes of all time.
As a defensive tackle at Central Connecticut State, could you imagine trying to tackle that guy?
Not a chance. Wouldn't have had a chance.
You know, a lot of times we think of the executives in the NFL, and we do know that players move into these management positions, but when we think of the executives, we don't necessarily think of a defensive tackle, Scott.
Now you're starting to sound like Belichick. He always used to make jokes about how much smarter offensive linemen were than defensive linemen. But really, our limitations weren't that bad, or aren't that bad.
You're listening to Sports Jam. I'm Doug Doyle. My guest is Scott Pioli, the assistant general manager of the NFL's Atlanta Falcons. Scott not only is a huge Jazz fan, but he's also a WBGO supporter, and we're thrilled he's taking time out from his summer home in Nantucket to join us here on Sports Jam. Before we talk about the Falcons, let's talk about just those two men that you mentioned who have made the New England Patriots, along with your architecture and touch with that unit.
Brady fires it to the right, down the right sideline, and caught at the 20-15-10 touchdown for Tom Brady. Touchdown pass number 50, an NFL record.
I tell you, Tom Brady is one of those guys who will headbutt you to get ready for a game, and he looks like he'll headbutt you to finish a game.
Tom Brady, he's been in the news, obviously, so many things. What makes Tom Brady Tom Brady?
That's a really good question, because the total package is it's remarkable. I don't know if I'll ever be around another football player in my life like Tom. And I'm not just talking about his physical skills, but in terms of work ethic, in terms of his focus. You know, people see Tommy now and they see the career that he's had, that he's having. And, you know, I was there when we drafted him in 2000. And I watched and saw all the things that Tommy used to do before he became Tom. And he's one of the hardest workers, one of the most disciplined people, and truthfully, one of the kindest people I've ever been around. And he just has this innate leadership quality and way about him in terms of being able to lead people and an authenticity that's unparalleled. I mean, it really is. I can't say enough great things about Tommy and who he is and what he is.
One thing other than his unbelievable talent and leadership is the thing that impresses me sometimes the most about him is that he cares when his team is losing.
Oh,
he can't stand it, can he?
No, and you know what? That was visible. He cannot stand to lose when he's involved. He can't stand to lose. I remember the year that he tore his ACL and he was injured and Matt Castle was our starting quarterback in 2008. He hated when we lost, and even when he wasn't participating. And truthfully, in 2000, even when he was a rookie and the fourth quarterback on our roster, he was always affected by winning and losing. Not as much about his personal performance, but whether the team won or lost. And everyone always understands that about Tommy, that Tommy is always about the greater good, not himself.
Let's lock him down out here. Let's lock him down. Oh, yeah, we got him. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see who's got who.
Bill Belichick still wears a hoodie on the sideline. He doesn't really care about people's perception of the way he looks, right? It's all about the W's in the end, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's Bill's, you know, Bill's about winning and winning football games, and that's, you know, he has a pretty simple philosophy about that, and he didn't get into this to become. Again, remember when Bill got into this? Head coaches were not, you know, they didn't become stars, they didn't become celebrities, they weren't these iconic figures. Maybe either there were a couple that were, but they really only were in the football world. Bill got in this because he's competitive, he loves the game, he respects the game, and he wanted to be a great coach. Again, a lot of the things that come along, as we call either the trappings or the celebrity, none of that's ever been important to Bill. He just wanted to be a head coach, and he wanted to be a great head coach, and he wanted to win. And he's doing a lot of it.
Well, he just continues to amaze. As the assistant general manager of the Atlanta Falcons, this team obviously wants to get to that summit too. Do you see the same hunger in each team that you go to? Are there real differences or what? Is the job different from team to team?
No, the job isn't different. And really the teams, again, because I've been with so many different franchises, the culture and the attitude and the personality comes a lot from ownership and how owners want their teams to perform. And everyone wants to win. Clearly, every owner wants to win. But the thing that's very similar to the situation in Atlanta as the other good places that I've been is that the owner cares and the owner wants to win, and he does everything to provide us, you know, with the opportunity to win.
There's really nothing about the NFL or football that I could ask you that you can't answer. So I'm going to flip.
Oh, there'd be plenty, trust me.
I'm going to flip it on
you're
you.
You're very kind.
And I'm going to ask you about another one of your passions, and that's jazz.
Yeah.
As you know, WBGO is the world's greatest jazz station, and you are a supporter of this, and we thank you very much for supporting WBGO. First of all, how do you like the CD of the Month Club?
I love it. I love, you know, it's so funny. People will probably think, wait a second, this guy lives in Atlanta. He spends a couple weeks in the summer in Nantucket. How does he? I've been live streaming WBGO as long as it's been able to be streamed on the internet. And you know, again, being from the Northeast, it's home. It's like listening to a slice of home. And I became a supporter because, again, I believe in public radio, and I believe in supporting public radio. So that, you know, it's it all makes sense to me.
All right. So here's the question. You're an architect, you know, you've built some great football teams, but now I want you to build a jazz trio, and they can be alive or dead. Who are the, and they don't have to have ever worked together. So who are your three people that you want on stage that will have that championship feel?
Does it have to be a trio or a quartet?
You can make it a quartet if you like.
I'd have to have Bill Evans. I mean, it'd have to be Bill Evans, Miles Davis. I might just go with the Miles Davis quartet or quintet. You know, I mean, why go outside? Why go outside?
Do you remember the first time jazz entered the psyche of Scott Pioli?
Well, absolutely, and I think it was there subliminally from my childhood, quite honestly, because you know, I mentioned my family members, and you know, during the entire my entire lifetime, music has been a big part of it. None of my family, my dad played the accordion. You know, every good Italian has to play the accordion when he's growing up. But you know, when I was growing up, and we went to my grandmother's place in the Bronx, and we spent a lot of time with my grandmother, there was always opera music. There was always some jazz. She was a Hoagy Carmichael fan, and as a matter of fact, I have all of her old 78 records to this day. And she was, of course, a Sinatra fan. And then my parents were always huge music fans. There was always music on in the house. A lot of it was pop music, or even for my parents' day, they were doo-wop people, so it was CBS FM. But my father had a very interesting record collection, and my parents have actually given me their record collection too. So I have all their old, what they call their rock and roll records, which are all the old 45s from the doo-wop days. I'm a big vinyl guy.
Great stuff.
Oh, it's incredible. And certain things just need to be listened to on vinyl. But my dad had all the doo-wop records and all the rock and roll records in one part of the house. But then he had this special collection that he wouldn't talk about it, but every once in a while he would pull out these records and play these records, and it was jazz music. So there was, every once in a while there would be jazz music, and it always intrigued me. And, you know, again, musically, I've been all over the place. I'm a huge jazz fan, but I truthfully love every single kind of music imaginable. And again, I've listened to, and I've spent a lot of time in every genre, but there's something, again, I can't point to an exact moment where I say, wow, this is really something. It was just something that I listened to and heard in the background of my home often. And then as I got older and needed thinking music and music without lyrics, jazz and classical music became a big part of, you know, my personal listening repertoire. So, but there are certain moments. I don't know how you feel about this, Doug, but there's certain moments where you not only love music, but there's certain songs that you can hear that have moments where there's aha moments. Like I remember the first time that I heard Peace by Bill Evans. I mean, it knocked me out. It's still one of the most remarkable tunes I've ever heard. Some days it just takes me to a place. It could go on forever. It's one of those songs that that ends far too soon. You know, it could keep going on and on and on, and I would never get tired of it or know if it was in a loop or not. I would just be in a trance. That's kind of my background in jazz. And then I just fell in love with it and started listening to different people. And again, I'm a huge Miles Davis fan, huge Bill Evans fan, Coltrane fan. I'm kind of all over the place. But I'm really a classic jazz listener. But I'm not so much of a smooth jazz guy. To me, there's a clear distinction between real jazz or classic jazz and smooth jazz. I hope I'm not offending anyone by saying that.
No, I don't think so, and especially not on WBGO, because you know that's our forte.
Right. There might be someone that changed the dial listening that may not feel good about that comment.
No, but, not at all. Not at all. I think we understand completely. Now, you've been judging and directing personnel for a long time. So, Bill Evans and Miles Davis walk into the office of the assistant general manager of the Atlanta Falcons, and let's say, you know, they're with us. Okay, they're alive and well. What do you want to ask those two guys?
Oh, gosh. Honestly, I don't want to ask them because I don't want to hear my own voice. I just want to hear them. I want to ask them, can they just play? Can I watch them play? I would love to watch them create something. You know, that's part of the beauty of what I do. My job is, you know, we watch these athletes that have these special gifts and they have these special abilities, and you watch them just do their own thing. Now, you coach them to a certain degree and you let, but when it comes down to it, they've got to do their own thing. And the real beauty in watching an athlete is letting them do what they do best without being told too much what to do. If I saw the two of them, I would just want to say, can I just sit with you and watch you make your magic? I wouldn't say a whole lot. I wouldn't say anything other than that, quite honestly. I would just love to see them create.
If the Falcons create magic on the football field this year and would happen to win the Super Bowl, what would that mean for Scott Pioli?
Oh, gosh. Your mouth to God's ears, Doug. What would that mean? It would be a remarkable... It would be incredible because part of the reason I took the job in Atlanta was to go to work with and alongside of one of my closest and dearest friends in the world, Thomas Dimitroff, who was our general manager. Thomas and I had our first jobs together in 1992 in Cleveland as entry-level workers, slappies, as they like to call us, which is short for something I can't say on radio. And then we worked together for 6 years in New England. He's one of my closest and dearest friends. And I, you know, as you mentioned earlier, I took that year away from football and was doing media work. And the primary reason that I came back and went to Atlanta was to work with one of my closest and dearest friends. So if I were able to win a championship, another one, because we won two together in New England, it would mean the world to me. I mean, it really would. And Thomas and I have cultivated this relationship with our head coach. It is really pretty special. The three of us, the dynamic of the three of us is unlike anything I've ever been a part of. And our head coach, Dan Quinn, who just so happens to be a Jersey guy, he's not Newark, but he's from Jersey. It'd be a pretty special thing, Doug.
I just have to ask you before we let you go, with we mentioned that in 2014, you were inducted into the National Italian American Sports Hall of Fame. We lost a couple people recently that were members of that Hall of Fame. Yogi Berra here in New Jersey, very much, and his boyhood friend Joe Garagiola just passed away.
Yeah.
What does Italian heritage? I'm more Italian than anything, and my dad would probably not be real happy for me to say that, but
yeah. So your mom must have married down when she was with the Doyle last thing.
Yeah, you could say that. I'm a Bortot when it comes to the Italian side. What does your heritage mean for you?
It means an awful lot. It's something I'm very proud of. you know, my grandparents. It means a lot. I get very emotional when I talk about it. I've got to tell you, one of the moment when I was inducted into the New England chapter of the Italian American Sports Hall of Fame, and then the national one, they were really emotional times for me because, again, I always go back to my family and the work that my family did. And, again, I know I've mentioned my Grandma Rose a number of times already. I cannot emphasize the importance of her, her strength, and our heritage between the Pioli's, the Costas, and the Beccarelli's. It has been a driving force in my life. And I've taken a lot of, you know, I take a lot of pride in representing my heritage the right way and the appropriate way. It means an awful lot to me, Doug.
Well, it means an awful lot that you've taken some time here to join us on Sports Jam, Scott. And, you know, continued success. And I have to admit, I'll be rooting for the Atlanta Falcons after doing this show with you.
Well, Doug, I really appreciate that. It truly is an honor, and I don't say that lightly. And I listen to BGO all the time, and it's an honor to be a part of this and an honor to be on your show. So thank you very much for having me.
Sports Jam is a WBGO News production. You can check out all the shows by going to WBGO.org/SportsJam. Or find Sports Jam with Doug Doyle on iTunes. Special thanks to the Atlanta Falcons for helping us out this week, as well as our buddies at NFL Films for the clips in the show. Until our next Sports Jam session, I'll see you at the game.